this Chinese proverb which says, a good traveler has no fixed plans and is not intent on arriving. Well, in many ways, that describes the process in which the Book of Secrets was assembled. When I think of it, I approached it as a travel writer might approach the preparation for a book, in that one latches onto certain thematic or historical threads and follows them into the unknown, and yet at the same time expands on those threads with their own experience and imagination. Up until 1991, I was under the impression that the Celts were this mad collection of anarchists from Ireland, Scotland, and Wales, only to learn via an exhibition in Venice that they were this vast collection of tribes originating from Middle and Eastern Europe as far back as 500 BC, and that over the centuries they migrated and integrated with people all over the world. So I've used this pan-Celtic history as a creative springboard, and with the Book of Secrets in particular, I was interested in beginning with their earlier and more Eastern history. I spent a lot of time in Italy, which then became my geographical hub for research, and in essence let the process of discovery unfold from there. When I'm researching, the process takes various forms. I read a lot of different kinds of books. Travel writing, of course. Fictional stories set in the time and place of my interest. I listen to various kinds of music and study the instruments and their idioms. But ultimately, if I can, I try to visit a place because I don't think there's any better way than absorbing and taking on all that sensual information than smelling the streets and seeing the light in the sky, and that really there's no book or radio documentary that can compare to that whole exercise. What do I call my music? Well, that's a good question. Sometimes I call it eclectic Celtic. But I guess in many respects, it is a kind of world music in the broadest sense of that word. There were 28 musicians involved in this recording. For example, there were times when a viol da gamba was playing with a tin whistle, or a rebec was playing with Middle Eastern drums, or the St. Petersburg choir singing an Orthodox Easter hymn. So because I think the musicians and myself come from such a broad spectrum of musical styles, there are bound to be these influences woven into the fabric of my music. I, for example, come from a classical and folk background. Brian Hughes, my guitarist, comes from a rock and jazz background. Hugh Marsh, my violinist, comes from a very experimental and an innovative musical background. Rick Lazar, my percussionist, comes from a Latin and world music background, as does Donald Kwan. When in the springtime of the year, when the trees are crowned with leaves. There's no question at the core of what I do is a Celtic or an Irish sound, but it is embroidered with these Eastern and Middle Eastern influences. And insofar as world music has had such an impact on mainstream music, it is not uncommon that my music would be found in the pop bin. What is it about my music people find interesting or attractive? Well, that's a question I don't really feel very comfortable answering, and I feel probably not the best person to answer it. I mean, I still find it startling to go to places like Turkey and find them playing my rendering of God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen on the main street of Istanbul on a summer's night in July. and yet this project has sold over 200,000 recordings there. Clearly, there is something in the music and not even in the language or the content that is connecting. There is a Celtic sound in what I do, and there is a rather infectious quality about Celtic music. I imagine there's something about that, the eclecticism of the arrangement, maybe a quality of my voice that adds up to something unusual. Beyond that, it's not my position to say. In the course of my research, one of my first expeditions was to a place called Bobbio up in the north of Italy. It was the site of the first Irish monastery in Italy, and its history can be connected to part of this continuous eastern and western migration of monastic communities in the Middle Ages. And I had encountered or read a book with a rather preposterous title called How the Irish Saved Civilization, written by a man called Thomas Cahill. And I, along with no doubt thousands of others, were curious to exactly how they did this. But his thesis was that as the Roman Empire was disintegrating, numerous monks were copying out ancient Greek and Latin, classical and religious texts, and were reintroducing these texts to the continent. And were it not for their efforts, much of this material would have been lost to us forever. So the Skellig piece actually refers to the Skellig Islands off the west coast of Ireland, which is one of the most extremely remote locations where monks were copying out these texts in states of rather severe isolation. And when I visited Bobbio high up in the mountains, it came across to me as the mountainous equivalent of the Skellig Islands.
Light the candle, John. The daylight is almost gone. Birds have sung their last, the bells call out to mass. Seat ye by my side, for the night is very long. There's something I must heal before I pass along.
Well, I've always had a great interest in the subjects of religion and spirituality, and in looking at this corner of religious history, of the many questions that are running through your mind, one is, what is the connection between isolation and religious or spiritual experience, or even just understanding how little we know about the mechanics of the human soul? We recorded the Book of Secrets at Real World Studios in England. It's a wonderful recording facility of Peter Gabriel's nestled into the Wiltshire countryside, comprised of various sizes and configurations of studio space. And at times it felt almost like a cross-section between a commune and a kibbutz. There were so many people and different kinds of people around. But because there were these other projects going on at the same time, you had the opportunity to engage with other artists and bands, their producers and engineers, often over the dinner table, but sometimes you would be invited into their studio space to watch what they were doing. What made this arrangement particularly attractive to me was that I knew that as the recording evolved, I would probably want to access a rather eclectic assemblage of instruments and musicians on short notice. And the proximity of London, only an hour and a half away, and teeming with all sorts of players, meant that I could paint, musically speaking, quite spontaneously. And of course, this is not to mention that Real World has a rather impressive Rolodex, and I have to confess we tapped into that from time to time. There were so many great things about the design of the main control room. One of the strongest for me was the fact that the front window was quite expansive, and leading out onto that was a pond in which there were ducks and swans preening themselves. And you remain connected to the time of the day and the seasons. But also, the space was constructed so that you could have 13 or more people on the deck playing off of each other and feeling connected to the music and the track in a way that I think is more difficult when they're going down in a more measured and calculated manner. I'm often asked about my attraction to setting other writers' lyrics or poetry to music. And I guess the reason I've done this is to not only give a different perspective to a recording, but also a certain kind of weight. So, for example, in The Visit, I used some of Shakespeare's material. I used some of his material again on The Mask and Mirror, as well as W.B. Yeats, St. John of the Cross. When it came to the poem The Highwayman, I just simply felt it was this gorgeously evocative tale which many would have studied at school. It came to me at the suggestion of some friends, and this is not uncommon that I would have materials suggested to me. So I felt that, as I usually like a narrative in the mix of functions or pieces on a recording, that this was a strong contender.
The wind was a torrent of darkness among the gusty trees. The moon was a ghostly galleon tossed upon the cloudy seas. The road was a ribbon of moonlight over the purple moor. And the highwayman came riding, riding, riding. The highwayman came riding up to the olden door. He had a French cocktail on his forehead, bunch of lace at his chin, a coat of claret velvet, and breeches of brown doe skin. They fitted with never a wrinkle, his boots were up to the thigh, and he rode with a jewel twinkle, his pistol buds a twinkle, his rapier hilt a twinkle under the jeweled sky. And over the cobbles it clattered, clashed in the darkened yard, and he tapped with his whip on the shutters, but all was locked and barred. He whistled a tune to the window, and who should be waiting there but the landlord's black-eyed daughter, past the landlord's daughter, plaiting a dark red love knot into her long black hair.
I first visited Venice in 1991 to see the Celtic exhibition there. It's always interesting to go to a place about which you've heard so much, and I must admit I was yet one more in millions to be struck by the poetic beauty of the city and the composition of the buildings, the canals and the water, the reflections. And yet with so many beautiful things, you come to learn they are like prisms with lesser known dimensions. And I was eager to learn more about these dimensions as always. Sometimes quite disturbing ones, like the history of the Jewish quarter and the restrictions placed in that community, or the multifaceted crossroads of the East and West which occurred there in Venice. Originally, as a result of what I suspected was going to be a rich fountain of inspiration, I set the working title for the recording as The Ghosts of Venice. But as the research and writing evolved, I felt that the title was going to be too restrictive in ways. I think that with many artists and rich, evocative environments like Venice, one is pulled to create their own articulation of all that information, sensual or otherwise. The challenge on my part was really the arrangements and the instrumentation and the idioms of the playing become much more important in conjuring a place and time. talk about being a traveler with no fixed plans. This train trip across Siberia sort of occurred in that way. In December of 1995, I was on tour as a guest of the Chieftains in Japan. And at the end of the tour, still feeling in the need for yet more adventure, I decided I would take the Trans-Siberian Express. During this time, I was still ruminating on the themes and subjects of the recording, and I wanted a stretch of uninterrupted time to digest some of the research I had been doing before I left for Japan. So only on the thread of a connection that the early Celtic people might have come from the Russian steppes, I decided to embark upon this Trans-Siberian adventure. I remember coming down from the steps of the Aeroflot aircraft under the tarmac at Vladivostok, feeling I'd entered the world of Dickens. Coal smoke hung in the air and the lighting was very dim. On the way to the train station, people were gathered around barrels of fire, having sort of appeared out of nowhere and going nowhere. They're almost ghost-like. And I began to feel this clammy air of desperation of those around me, which prevailed in varying degrees for the week I was on the train. As I was traveling alone and virtually no one spoke English, one of my personal victories was the building of a friendship between myself and a female steward who began very, very suspicious of me, because you wouldn't encounter too many single Western women taking this train across Siberia on their own. But it must have been about after the third day, around lunchtime, I gave this woman a package of smoked salmon that I had brought with me from Canada, and with the intention that she would share it with her female colleagues, which she did. And after their lunch, she comes back to me, and instead of these scowls and suspicious glances, there was this broad grin in her face, and she says, "My name is Galia." And from that time, she really looked out for me. Take me with you on this journey, where the boundaries of time will melt us. In cathedrals of the forest, in the wells of the tongues will last. I think creative people have a great thirst for stimulation, and obviously there are various ways you can get that. For me, a large part of that comes from traveling, and it's fueled by my curiosity. But I feel very fortunate to be doing what I'm doing, that I'm able to marry my passions and interests and talents together, and financially support myself at the same time. I think there's a lot to be learned from the past, and in finding out what relevancies there might be for us in these highly technological times. But I think one of the most wonderful and fascinating things I've learned in the process of approaching the recordings this way is that we are this culmination and extension of each other's histories. That there is probably more to bind us together than separate us, and maybe that our needs are timeless and universal. Thank you.
all the paths were overgrown. When the breeze of pride say there is no other way, I tilled the sorrows of stone. I did not believe because I could not see, though you came to me in the night. When the dawn seemed forever lost, you showed me your love. Cast your eyes on the ocean, cast your soul to the sea, where my dark night seems endless. Please remember.